On Friday, the 4th of June, 1847, the bustling city of Edinburgh was brought to a standstill under a heavy blanket of sorrow. Many shops and businesses were closed, and worship services were held in churches throughout the city that morning. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a procession formed on the south side of the city to escort a coffin to the Grange Cemetery. Inside the coffin was the bodily remains of the Free Church of Scotland minister, Thomas Chalmers. The procession constituted thousands of people, including members of the town council in their full regalia, other prominent political leaders, and a host of Free Church ministers and elders who had been gathered in General Assembly at the time of Chalmers' death early that week. And to that was added a number of people from the pew. An estimated 100,000 people lined the streets of Edinburgh to catch a glimpse at the coffin as it passed through. It ended up being the largest funeral in the history of Scotland up to that period, more than any king, more attended it than any king in Scotland. Thomas Carlyle, the well-known Scottish essayist and poet, wrote that Thomas Chalmers was the chief Scottish man of his time. Similar assertions flowed from various quarters, alleging that he had in fact shaped the nation within his generation. Indeed, the name Thomas Chalmers is second only to that of John Knox in terms of being used for place names and otherwise. The thought of a death of a Free Church minister, or any Presbyterian minister for that matter, producing this kind of response is inconceivable in our day. And it provokes the question, who was this influential man of God? And it is to that question that we turn in our address this morning. The story begins with Thomas Chalmers' birth on March 17th, 1780, in the small coastal town of Anstruther in Fife. This is on the east coast of Scotland and on the north side of the Firth of Forth. But it may help for the children to tie the birth of Chalmers, really his life, to our own context here in South Carolina. So at the time of Chalmers' birth, children, the United States did not exist. Indeed, South Carolina was in the throes and middle of the War of Independence, a war fought against the British Crown. Chalmers would be 7 when the Constitution was ratified, and 9 years old when our first president, George Washington, was elected. At the time, South Carolina was in a confederation of colonies. And think of the first year, less than the first year of his life. He's born on March 17th. What was happening here in the upcountry of South Carolina at the time? Well, these battles, the names of these battles will be well known to you because they're all around us. The Battle of the Waxhaws took place, the Battle of Camden, the Battle of King's Mountain, and the Battle of Cowpens, all from the day of his birth until he was 10 months old. So that's what was transpiring here in South Carolina at the time. When he died at the age of 67, South Carolina was 13 years away from seceding from the Union and the onset of the war between the states. And so between these two significant periods within South Carolina history, both the First War for Independence and then the Second War for Southern Independence, the life of Thomas Chalmers is squeezed in between those two poles. But for the purposes of our address this morning, it might be especially helpful to have a little bit of the Scottish context into which he came into this world. During the 1700s, the Church of Scotland had gone through a period of significant spiritual downgrade and spiritual departure. They had left the high attainments of the Second Reformation at the end of the previous century, and there had been, of course, the influence of the Enlightenment, and within the Church, the rise of what became known as the Moderates, or the Moderate Party within the Church. Their influence was pervasive. What was important for them and for much of the Church was being respectable and civil. They viewed the Church more as a social entity rather than a spiritual entity, so there was no zeal for gospel preaching. Instead, the pulpits were filled with the drivel of moral lessons and character formation and so on. No evangelism. And they were suspect of things that they considered enthusiasm, being overly zealous in matters of conversion and personal piety. Thomas Chalmers himself ended up falling under the influence of this in his early days, but writing later about the Moderates, he described their sermons to be, quote, like a winter's day, short and clear and cold. He said, the brevity is good, the clarity is better, the coldness is fatal. Moonlight preaching ripens no harvest. And so at the time of his birth, there was little evidence that the more reformed and evangelical minority within the Church would have much impact at all. Chalmers was born into a godly family. He was one of 14 children. He was the sixth child and fourth son of the family. He was born into a godly home, and the children in that home grew up with the influence of their father's large library of devotional books and the older Reformed literature. Indeed, it was hailed as one of the finest in that area, in that part of Fife. And early on, Chalmers especially took an interest in Bunyan's classic, Pilgrim's Progress, which he read over and over and over again until it was embedded deep within his own mind. At age three, he was sent to the local parish school. And all indications are that at first, though he was an affable child, he was more interested in what was physical, sports, and so on, and less than in the academics, which he later became known for. He had many colleagues, of course, at that time, and friendships, which also had an influence on him. It was at the age of 11 that he was sent to the nearby, relatively, St. Andrew's University, which is one of the most ancient institutions in Scotland. And even in his day, being sent to university at age 11 was very unusual. So it was very young for him to be going off. He, at first, his performance was so-so, I would say, nothing spectacular. But in the latter part of his studies, he came under the spell of mathematics and took a keen interest, a lifelong interest, in mathematics. It had an intoxicating influence upon him. And so he threw himself into mathematics and then, to a lesser degree, into the sciences and so on. It was also during that period that he had his first and early contact with Edwards. So Chalmers is unconverted, but he's wowed by the intellectual prowess of Edwards. He had read his book on the will, had a sense of the grandeur of God as a creator and so on. But he was living and being shaped in a moderate, explicitly moderate environment. And most of the teaching focused not on theology, systematics, and biblical godliness, but more on natural and moral philosophy. But it was also at the same time that he began to discover and develop his rhetorical skills. He ends up becoming renowned for his oratory, his ability to communicate in ways that are gripping and impactful on the people. That later, of course, was used by God so that gifts were wed with grace and then later harnessed in the advance of the evangel and the kingdom of the Lord Jesus Christ. he decided at that period that it would be good for him to pursue the ministry. Ministry was a very dignified profession, was viewed very highly at the time. It was also within this moderate context, rather comfortable living, and so he sought or began to seek license in the Church of Scotland to be licensed to preach. However, he bumped up against a rule, which was that no one could be licensed before they were 21. However, there was a small exception in the wording of the church legislation that gave him some help and some hope. He discovered that there were possibilities for those who had, quote, singular and rare qualities. And indeed, the presbytery found this persuasive. On July 31st, 1799, he was licensed to preach, and he was sent to the parish of Kilmeny. This is a rural parish about 9 miles northwest of St. Andrews. So he was born in a town, let's say, 9 miles kind of southeast of St. Andrews. He's going 9 miles northwest of St. Andrews. He settled in a rural parish, but a very comfortable one. He was very well paid, high pay, especially for a student going to his first charge. But he was attracted to the post because he would have the ability to simultaneously teach mathematics and a few other subjects at the university at St. Andrews. And he gained some notoriety for being an entertaining lecturer. And he spoke about this. He said, this is wonderful. The ministry is so easy that I can spend all week in the university studying math and doing all these other things that I'm interested in. Indeed, he would actually leave town and go all week to St. Andrews and come home and, with a little preparation on Sabbath morning, preach on that day and go back to the things that he was really interested in. And so that's a problem. We have an unconverted minister that is not taking seriously the calling that he's been given, and his sheep were suffering as a result of it. We also see something of his character coming out even in those early days. He was rather belligerent. He could be, especially before his conversion, condescending and headstrong in his dealings with other people. But in 1809, the Lord began to do a work, and it started with him contracting the disease that was then called consumption, or TB. It had killed his sister, and one sister and one brother. And so he was laid low during that period. His reading was not really that edifying. There were a few little pieces, but he improved and gained some recovery from that. But that it was the beginning of a series of things. He was engaged to a girl, and that failed, which was a huge blow to him. And then subsequently, another sister who he was close to also died of consumption. And it was on the heels of this, on the back side of this, that he picked up William Wilberforce's book, The Practical View. It's the short title. And he began to read it. And as he did, he discovered something that he had never seen before. Here was a man who was writing about biblical religion, about gospel, about the need of a new heart, of being converted, and so on. And the Lord accompanied that and began to bring him under the conviction of sin and to show him his own spiritual needs, which culminated over that period of time, ultimately, in his sound and saving conversion under the gospel. And immediately as a result, there were massive changes that took place, not just for him personally, but especially within his ministry. And the people began to recognize it. All of a sudden, the content changed, the manner changed, the heart and burden of the minister changed, not only in the pulpit, but in his mixing with the people, among the people. Attendance went from 70 to 200 over a short time, when those in the community began to be attracted to this preaching of the gospel. He went on, of course, to go back and make up for some of his studies. He studied Calvin's Institutes carefully. He rediscovered the Puritans and Reformed literature of the previous century and began to consume that, a heavy diet of all of that. In 1812, he married Grace Pratt. and she was in every way a helpmeet to him. She was a great balance to his impulsive and sometimes extravagant behavior. In 1815, he was called from Kilmeny to the Tron Church in Glasgow. This is a church in the center, city center of Glasgow, and you can go and see it today. It had a long history going all the way back into the 15th century, and history during the time of the Reformation and past. And his preaching in this little rural village had begun to create some interest and notice, and so he receives this call to the Tron Church, a parish of about 11,000 people. But when he got there, he discovered, to his chagrin, that a city ministry was very different from what he had been accustomed to. There were all sorts of expectations, social expectations, and so he had to go to this event and that event, and his calendar was being filled with all of these kind of civic responsibilities, which quite frankly irritated him. And so he decided, much to the offense of many in the parish, to throw all of that off. He canceled it. He said, I'm not participating in it. I'm not going to have a part in these things anymore. I have to give myself to the ministry. And so he poured himself into preaching, and he began visiting those in the parish house to house. This would not only include the majority, which were Church of Scotland people, but also those among the secession churches that had split from that earlier, and Roman Catholics, and others. He also instituted midweek meetings, where preaching would take place during the week. He divided his parish up into 25 districts, and recognized that the 8 elders that he had were completely inadequate for all that he wanted to accomplish. 12 younger men were added, raising the eldership to 20, and he began to employ them in going into the community and dealing not only with pastoral needs in the congregation, but also in reaching those who were unchurched and unconverted. He established Sunday schools at the time, which grew, and he took an early interest in a distinctively Christian education. Indeed, through his efforts, 40 schools were started. That constituted half of the schools in the entire city of Glasgow, which is the biggest city in Scotland. In addition to other things, he had a midweek meeting at noon in the city center on a Thursday. So this would be very unusual and not what most people would consider an attractive time. But he did it in the middle of the workday, where men could, at lunch, leave their work, walk to the church, and participate in the services. And it was there that he delivered what came to be known as his astronomical discourses. He was taking some of his background and then bringing the Bible to bear on all of that and speaking on themes that were very attractive. And indeed, it was so popular that on a Thursday at noon, in the middle of the week, he would have 3,000 people attending these lectures. They were wildly popular. He went on to publish them, and 6,000 copies sold within 2 weeks. Indeed, when it first came out, his astronomical discourses were selling more copies than Walter Scott's novels, which is saying a great deal at the time. Now, if you ever pick up a copy, as I did many moons ago, and try to read the astronomical discourses, you'll wonder to yourself, how were these ever popular? Because they're incredibly dry to read. But you have to remember, those who were reading them were also those who sat under the delivery of them. And there's also a discrepancy between what he delivered and what he ended up writing up for publication. But they would have sat under the delivery of a man that was remarkably gifted in terms of his rhetorical and oratorical abilities. And so as they read them in the experience of hearing Chalmers' voice and all that was transpiring at the time, which is about the only explanation I can come up with as to why they were so popular, at least from our vantage point. He ran into a number of difficulties, of course. He was a passionate man and a strong leader. It was sanctified by grace, And of course, he was one who walked closely with the Lord, but he nevertheless ran into all sorts of conflict. You see it even with his publishers early on, one of which he ditched, blaming them for inability to market the books well and so on. He wrote on all sorts of things. I mean, his works are large. He wrote on not only theology, obviously, and sermons, obviously, and some devotional literature, but he also produced things ranging from political theory and economics and astronomical discourses and things on science and so on. He was something of a Renaissance man in that sense. His vast array of interests and so on, all utilized and harnessed for the good of the kingdom. But he also took a keen interest in the poor. Now, at the time, of course, with the reign of the Moderate Party, Christianity was superficial, dignified, polite, but there was very little interest in taking the gospel to those who were disenfranchised, to those who were weak and poor. And so he took a keen interest in this, and this became a dominant thing in his ministry. He had amazing abilities at raising money. He raised tremendous money for the poor, and created whole structures through which the poor were not only provided with their sustenance, but also the ability to develop their latent gifts and to be able to employ them to improve their well-being, as practical as helping them know how to clean and repair their houses and to be able to gain better employment and so on. All of this through the work of the church, distinct from the state. So this was a separate vein that that he was seeking to develop. His time at the Tron closed, and he moved to St. John's Parish, which is also in Glasgow. And he began there an experiment of taking some of the model that he had started at Kilmeny and bringing it to the city. So some of the things I've already touched on, he developed more fully. So he huge focus on schools. He started schools again, opened a school there, did so apart from the state and in a way that was, through fundraising, affordable, even for the poorest to be able to send their children to. And of course, in these schools, they were taught the Bible and the Psalter and the Catechism and biblical religion and godly piety, along with the other parts of the arts curriculum, liberal arts curriculum, that would enable them to develop their gifts and pursue various vocations. He started four schools in connection with the parish there. When he left, there were 419 boys ranging between ages 6 and 15 that were attending these schools. I said something about his eldership. He also did more than any had done before him for a long time in terms of developing and employing the work of the deacons. Indeed, there's a whole body of literature that's well worth recovering, I think, on this score. All of the systems and training and programs that he put into place at a diaconal level. He was one who was proactive rather than reactive. So he was trying to identify what the problems were and then come up with solutions and address them rather than just waiting. So what I mean by that is the difference between proactive and reactive. It wasn't that the deacons in the church waited for people to come and say, hey, I have a need or I have a problem, and then responding to that. Instead, as I noted a moment ago, he actually went out positively initiating context and actually training the local populace in terms of temporal and practical duties and responsibilities. This all had multiple layers of accountability coupled with spiritual nurture and oversight and so on. But the sum and substance of his ministry still was a focus on preaching. He preached four times on the Sabbath. He preached midweek throughout the week as well. He did spontaneous evangelistic services. He would hold services in different parts of the parish in order to get the immediate community to come, smaller gatherings as it were, and preach the gospel to them. He worked on church extension, so looking for ways to plant new churches, again, that were not funded through the endowment that the Church of Scotland had through the state, but what were called chapels of ease, money that was raised independent of it, for church extension that was more rapid and more solid than those who would want to, who would be cautious about the development, especially in poorer areas of churches and so on. In 1823, he was called to St. Andrews. His health was waning a little bit. He was very worn out, and he decided to go to St. Andrews in order that he might invest in the future leadership of the church and of Scotland. He ran into all sorts of conflicts there, which is kind of the case with Chalmers at various stages of his ministry. But in 1828, he went to the University of Edinburgh, and this is kind of the busiest period of his life, from 1828 until his death. And in some ways, it was where he had the most formative influence, because he influenced a whole generation of ministers. So the bulk of a great number of those who ended up becoming Free Church ministers were trained under Chalmers. And beyond that, he had influence far afield. So he was going and appearing before Parliament, and he was giving speeches there in order to accomplish things for the church. He dialogued and networked with various political figures. He had influence at a whole array of different tiers for the gospel within Scotland. It was while he was at the University of Edinburgh that what we call in Free Church history the 10 years conflict ensued. So this is the 10 years that preceded the Great Disruption, when the Free Church of Scotland came into existence. So during the 10 years conflict, this whole period and the disruption would require its own lecture, series of addresses. But at the heart of it was a problem. And the problem was called patronage. So patronage was a system in which the landowners who had civil titles, the patrons, had a say in who would be called to serve as a minister within the church on their land. And so what that meant was this, that rather than the crown rights of Christ being carried out within the context of the church, and the principles of Presbyterian church government being upheld, where the people themselves chose and elected their own ministers, instead that was taken out of their hands, and it was given to someone who held what was a civil post. And all of this was protected and codified within the laws of Scotland, and upheld by the government. And so what would happen is a patron would choose somebody that they liked, and they would impose that minister on the congregation. And in many cases, it was against the will of the people. You might have gospel-believing people, reformed people in the pew, and a minister is taken away, and the patron would actually appoint a liberal, you know, someone that was broad and who didn't preach the gospel and so on, to the chagrin of the people, right? So they would end up, many of them, staying away from the church and so on. Well, this had to be tackled, and Chalmers was at the forefront of this. He was kind of the spearhead in terms of confronting this unbiblical arrangement. And he exerted enormous amounts of influence and even in places of significant power. Over the 10 years, there were a series of things that took place within the church, interfacing with the state. Ultimately, it led to the disruption, what we call the Great Disruption, within the Church of Scotland. At the time, you had three parties. You had the Moderate Party, which was kind of dominant, and then you had the Conservative Party, called Evangelical at the time, and then you had a middle party that was saying, well, we agree with the more Reformed or Evangelical people, but let's just negotiate and, you know, kind of mamsy-pamsy method of addressing it. Chalmers, on the other hand, and those who were laboring with him, people like Candlish and others, were more strident. They were unwilling to tolerate these biblical compromises, because they affected the crown rights of Christ. You're taking what belongs to the church and you're giving it to the state, which flies in the face of the King, Christ himself, and is a provocation of him. This all culminated on May 18th, 1843, as you probably know. It's an important date in our church's history. David Welsh was the moderator of the General Assembly. They gathered in St. Giles. He preached a stirring sermon there, and then they transferred to St. Andrews, where the assembly was going to be held. He got up in the introductory things and laid down the protest, the famous protest against the actions that had preceded the assembly, and then he quietly walked out, followed by Chalmers and a whole host of others, and they made their way to Tanfield Hall, where the Free Church of Scotland was constituted. Immediately, Thomas Chalmers himself, the face of the Free Church at the beginning, if you will, the one who had done so much as a leader of the Conservatives in the Church of Scotland, was elected as the first moderator of the Free Church General Assembly. They sang on that occasion Psalm 43. The result was nearly 500 ministers leaving the C of S, the Church of Scotland, to constitute the Free Church of Scotland. Countless, hundreds and hundreds of elders, and nearly half of Scotland, right? So they all go into this new church, the Free Church of Scotland, or as it was called initially, the Church of Scotland Free, free from the interference of the civil magistrate, and free to follow Christ and his law. So the bulk of Scotland follows them. And, of course, the Free Church starts off in very desperate circumstances. They're booted from their manses. They're taken. The church buildings are all taken away. There are no stipends for the ministers, and so on. And so from 1643 to 1647, Chalmers is active in laying the foundation for the Free Church, the securing of buildings, the securing of manses. We have, at that point, the New College, which is still there on the mound just next to the castle, in the heart of Edinburgh. New College, which was established as a Free Church school. They engaged in all sorts of missionary enterprise. There were lots of the missionaries that were Church of Scotland missionaries that joined the Free Church. They weren't insular. They were looking outward. And from this point of deprivation and literal poverty. I mean, there are accounts given, as I said, this is another address, of men who were put into such abject poverty. There's one minister and his son, who was also a minister, that died, right? No food, nothing, in remote areas, and so on. But this tremendous swell of work and outpouring and the blessing of the Spirit and the Spirit-sent revival that preceded all of this were owned from heaven, and the Lord used Chalmers' leadership to establish the Free Church. In Edinburgh, here's Chalmers. He's at the end of his life. He's, you know, advanced in years, but his heart throb for the people, for the gospel, you know, for the advance of the kingdom was still full of life and strength. And so it's in his later years that he takes up what was called the Westport Experiment. So he's in Edinburgh, and he chose Westport, which was a district that was the poorest of the poorest in the city of Edinburgh. So you're talking homeless people, prostitutes, you know, super high crime, and so on and so forth. And he said, this is what I'm taking. This is the portion of the city I'm going to own. And a work was started. There was house-to-house stuff, there was a school that was erected, there was a church that was planted. He, of course, had many others that were assisting him with this in bringing about, really, a transformation to what you would think of as the darkest, the bleakest part of Edinburgh. But it shows you something of the man in terms of his heart for gospel labor. Well, on the Sabbath, May 30th, Chalmers got up that morning. He attended worship as usual. He came home after the second service that evening, held family worship, and went to bed early, not feeling so well. And when his housekeeper went to arouse him in the morning, because he was late for an appointment, she discovered that he had died in the night, died apparently of a heart attack at 67 years of age. And it was later that day, it was later that week, that on Friday, the funeral that I described at the beginning of the address took place, and all of Scotland mourned what was, in many ways, their greatest leader. He was referred to by one of the civil magistrates in Edinburgh on the day of his funeral as their king. He said, "Go carry forth your king to his rest." So a man of tremendous influence. But let me draw a few lessons. I mean, his life, I've given you a very brief overview of a few high points. It would take far more to cover it in detail, and there's much to glean from him. But I notice a few things that I think are remarkable. First of all, this is a man who has national renown, who has national influence, and yet his heart was always first and foremost for the local church. His number one priority everywhere he went was the local church. It wasn't the grand scheme. It wasn't the big stuff that was, you know, he wasn't trying to steer, as it were, the whole ship. He focused on the little patch of ground that the Lord had entrusted to his own care, which is really remarkable, because a man of this stature and influence restricted himself in so many ways to prioritizing the local church. I think we have something to glean from that, myself included. He saw that by pouring himself into the local scene and an impact on the local community, that the greatest effect for gospel advance could take place. And that was true not only within the parish that he was living, but it was also true in terms of the broader church, that in these various enterprises that I described, with the poor, with the schools, you know, with eldership and diaconate and all of these other things, he used the local church as an incubator to create models that could then be duplicated elsewhere. So his goal at St. John's, or even at the Tron, or wherever, he was seeking to actually carry out, implement biblical ideas, and to shape them so that they could then be taken elsewhere by other people and implemented in their own locale. I think also his focus on the local church was fueled by the fact that he was thinking long term. Right? He wasn't thinking of a flash in the pan. All the stuff he was doing were structures that were going to outlive him, that would endure, that would have long-term influence on multiple generations. So there's something there, I think, for all of us, ministers especially, but others also to glean from. Second thing is the priority of preaching. So I've noted that he was very good at grabbing hold of a vision and implementing it. That never supplanted his bread and butter. So he was first and foremost a preacher. Indeed, that's what he's known for. I mean, in his own day, we look back with hindsight on all of the things that he accomplished. But in his own day, he was a preacher. He was a preacher of the gospel. People came to sit under his ministry because he preached the gospel in ways that were powerful and impactful upon them. And his preaching was renowned. People came from all over the world to sit under his preaching, visiting the places that he labored. And you can read in your own leisure some of the accounts of those who heard him, the descriptions of it. At the center of all of it was the gospel. So he was a gospel evangelistic preacher, first and foremost. He preached the whole counsel of God, and he nurtured the people in the things of the faith. But at the heart of it was his desire to win the lost. So again, he's not insular. Right, he's not inward focused. He's trying to reach the unconverted in his church, bring the unconverted in, go to the unconverted outside of his church. And he always had an eye, of course, to missions and the world beyond as well. So preaching was his priority above everything else. But you have to recognize, and we all have to admit, he was a visionary. He was a visionary in every sense of the word. He was a phenomenal leader. There are other people who may have thought, well, you know, this is an idea and that's an idea. But he had the ability to take a vision and to lead, to organize, to implement, to bring it to pass. In other words, he wasn't an ivory tower type, though he was a significant intellectual. I mean, he had the prowess of gifts in that area, but he was a man of action. He was a man of momentum. And he wouldn't wait, as it were, for everyone else to kind of see what he saw or to get on board, right? In fact, that's part of the reason I think he ran into conflict at times. It was because, you know, this ship's leaving, you know, with or without. But he established in all of that a pattern for others, mobilizing. He was very good at mobilizing other people, recognizing gifts and abilities and their gifts and graces, and then equipping them, and then arranging for those who could equip others, and then to employ them, and to, you know, he was very big into the elders bringing people in, you know, sorting out where can they find a place. Let's have all hands on deck, as it were, you know, laboring for the cause that we're trying to carry forward here. So he was a visionary, and he was an amazing leader. But he's also known for his own personal piety. He had his weaknesses. He could be ruthless at times with those who differed with him. But he was a man of personal piety. Those closest to him, those that were in his, even the outer circles of contact with him, all wrote and all spoke of his own personal godliness, of his spiritual mindedness, of his ability to speak freely and fully about the things of the Lord in the common everyday interactions with the poorest of the poor, and with those that were in the highest echelons of government and so on. Not intimidated. Ability to bring Christ in and to speak of him and of his loveliness and of his glory and of his rights and of his authority as Lord and so on. He wasn't without his weaknesses, but his own personal piety shined brightly in his testimony and life. He was also a man given very strongly to principle. So no doubt, you know, he had had some formative influences in the house of his father, a godly evangelical man. He had gone through a season of influence under moderatism, the kind of soft, squishy, I think I've referred to it in the past, perhaps in the pulpit, as marshmallow theology, right? This is the liberals give us marshmallow theology. It is soft and it is sicky sweet, and it has no nutritional value, right? He recognized that. And so he knew that the way forward was the way of truth, holding fast to the truth, uncompromisingly, belligerently, using that kind of bullheadedness to say, we will not bow and we will not bend when it comes to principles. That was true generally within Reformed theology and within church government, but you see it especially in the controversy over patronage. No half measures, no willingness, as it were, to compromise and to small gains. You know, we're speaking about Christ and his own crown rights, and it's not on the table for discussion. And so he held to principle in a vigilant and faithful way. He was also a man that was very future-oriented. He was very future-oriented. He wasn't consumed with himself or his immediate circumstances or even the success of the things that he was setting out to do. He was laying the groundwork for something that he knew would bear fruit in the future. He dies in 1847, right? So we're only 4 years after the disruption. The Free Church of Scotland ended up becoming a formidable force for good in Scotland, right? It, in many ways and at many levels, transformed Scotland, had a powerful influence at all sorts of levels, civilly and spiritually, over those succeeding years. Now, we all know the sad story of the downgrade that ends up taking place in the Free Church subsequently, leading later on in the century to the debates over union with the United Presbyterians and and all that went with that. But that first section of the first decade or two within the Free Church produced phenomenal men. I mean, you know, if you lived after the disruption in the lowlands of Scotland, I mean, you could go to Edinburgh or Glasgow, and some of the best preachers in 100 years were all preaching in different pulpits on that particular Sabbath. You could go from one church to the next, to the next, to the next, to hear some of the best preachers on the whole planet at the time. You had theologians, you know, the Free Church Synodus, the professors early on, Buchanan, Bannerman, Smeaton, Duncan, Cunningham, and so on. I mean, they exerted influence far beyond Scotland, including these United States of America. Delegations sent here to South Carolina in the South and in the North, into Canada and so on. The influence of Free Church theology upon developments in the cross-pollination with American Presbyterians and so on. Huge influence for good. But it was because he was future-oriented. He was looking, you know, what counted was not Thomas Chalmers. He didn't have any time for that. It was the true and credible advance of the kingdom. What can be done, what should be done, indeed what must be done in order to bring about over the subsequent years the greatest gain for Christ and for his kingdom. It's so easy for any of us to kind of collapse in on our own little world, our own little life, and our own little family, and our own little congregation, and so on, and not be thinking about those who are yet unborn. It's helpful, I think, for us to be praying for future generations, right? To be praying for those who are unborn, right? There are children here who are going to have children and grandchildren, and we should be praying for them. And when we're praying for them, then our mind and our affections are being pulled in that future-oriented direction. And it'll shape, you know, not only how we think, but what we do in the present hour in seeking to prepare things for their good as well. But it shows us, doesn't it, the life of a single person, one person, a little boy growing up in a very remote place, raised up by the Lord to bring about what amounts to a transformation of a whole nation within the spell of a single lifetime, and not a long one at that, dying at 67 years old. You'll understand why our publishing arm for our presbytery is called Grange Press. There's a little corner of this district south of Edinburgh called the Grange. It's a district in outside of Edinburgh. The graveyard there has all of the Free Church Fathers buried. So Chalmers' grave is there. I mentioned it at the beginning. And then some of the other names I've mentioned and many more buried in that place. But our publishing arm is called the Grange Press for that reason. And the logo is a profile of Chalmers. Right? You've all seen it. And now you have a little bit of an understanding of why he was, in those early days, in many ways, the face of the Free Church. And so we have a lot, I think, to gain from the study of his life. I hope that this address whets your appetite and that it'll lead you to digging deeper into some of the anecdotes and details of all that the Lord did with him and in him and through him for his own glory.